More farmers are installing solar panels on their land, in part because crop prices are falling and the state is providing incentives to do so. But some worry it's a waste of our fertile soil. Plus, Illinois State Board of Elections Director Steve Sandvoss joins us. He just told Congress we need more federal funding to replace our voting machines, and we'll check in with our neighbors to the east. Indiana's one of five states without a hate crime law. Its Republican state government is divided on how to change that.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks to Brian Moline for filling in for me yesterday. Coming up this hour, Illinois' head of elections says we need a lot more federal funding if we want to replace our state's voting machines in time for 2020. We'll also hear about some news happening across our border in Indiana. Its state legislature is in the middle of a debate on a hate crimes bill. And we'll speak to two Illinois scientists who are working to save penguins in Peru. But first, over the past few months, we've been hearing a lot about proposed legislation that would address climate change. You've probably heard about the Green New Deal on the federal level. Just last week here in Illinois, a bill was introduced that would expand the Future Energy Jobs Act and move Illinois to 100% renewable energy by 2050. Among farmers especially, solar power has become an eco-friendly way to supplement their income. This year, hundreds of people have applied to install acres of solar panels on their properties, spurred in part by state incentives and by lower crop prices. Joining us for more on this now is Randy DeBailey. He farms about 6,500 acres of corn and soybeans in Orion, Illinois, that's in Henry County near the Quad Cities. Hi, Randy. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you.
So, Randy, what do the solar panels look like on your farm?
If you can picture the footprint of, say, a 60 by 120-foot building, that's the amount of – that's the size of the footprint of the structure. They stand about 10 feet tall and go that 120-foot length, and there's two lines of panels. So very simple design. It's not very noticeable. It's if you don't know they're there, you really don't even notice them. They don't make any noise, very quiet.
And about how much energy are they providing right now?
That system is a 45 kW system, which, for an example, the system produces about double of what my farmstead uses in a day. So the extra energy produced on a nice sunny day, that's the energy that is banked through MidAmerica, my local energy supplier. And then that banked energy is used on cloudy days and at night.
And so I wonder how much state incentives played a role in getting you interested in putting solar panels on your farm, Randy?
Well, it's all about the dollars and cents as far as when I considered the purchase of the system. With the incentives in place, that put the payback at roughly 4.5 years for myself. And I had to finance the entire project. It was about $98,000 was what the purchase price was. So to pay for the interest for the financing, and then with the credits that are involved, including the tax credit, that got my payback down to 4.5 years. And I felt that was a very sound investment. So that's why we went ahead and put the structure up.
Randy, I wonder how you think that investment or that return on investment compares to what you're getting right now for your corn and soy. Was it for you a more reliable way of diversifying a little bit of your income and knowing that this would be a pretty reliable source? You would be able to know exactly how much you were getting back?
Yes, it was. That was considered. It was primarily the fact that after the 4.5 year period, then I would not have very many energy bills after that.
Right. Yeah. So that would be a huge savings.
It doesn't necessarily produce 100% all the time, because if I use more energy during the year, or if we have a lot of cloudy days, then I still may have a partial bill sometime in the summer if I've burned through all of my bank energy.
And was that really your motivation for why you wanted to put these panels in? What were you really thinking? What were you thinking about? Was it a dollars and cents? Was it about the environment? Was it lots of things?
Well, the dollars and cents was first, because I had to be able to pay for it. I had to be able to convince the bank that to get this loan, I have a sound investment, and I could prove to them that, yes, it does have a payback. I can make the payments in the timely manner, but also we do a lot of no-till farming in our area. We have fairly rough ground, so we are concerned with runoff. We are concerned with soil erosion. We work with a lot of younger landlords that are concerned with how their ground is taken care of, and we like to be able to state that DeBailey Ag is 100% solar powered at our farm site, and that's created a lot of interest in a lot of people. We've been contacted many times about the solar, how we installed it, why we installed it, and I think it's been a very good business decision for us, because of I think we've come across a lot of new contacts that we never would have gotten the opportunity to do had we not put the solar in.
Randy, you mentioned your tilling and what you have to do with the soil that you have in Orion. I wonder, farmers in Illinois always love to talk about how fertile the soil is here, and I wonder if you've gotten criticism, or what you would say to people who think you're wasting that land by not farming it.
I would call this a personal or residential structure, or even on a farm site, because it's not technically a solar farm, what I've installed. I've just got a solely owned installation that is used primarily just to power my operation. So as far as taking out a lot of land, it really wasn't any different than building a pole barn / Morton building. There wasn't a lot of ground loss. Now, we've got this 15 acres of ground that we have applied for construction of a solar farm in Rock Island County, and we've got it situated on a piece of flat ground that it's bottom ground, but it does not flood. It's not in the floodplain. It's not wetland. It is cropland, but because of where it is situated, there, you really can't tile the ground. You can't dry it out. It basically is what it is. So it's very low productive ground.
So you're taking that land.
Yes, we thought this would be a perfect spot for something like that, because it would give us a 3x return on our investment over and above what we can farm it for, because it is about 150 bushel the acre is about the best corn it will grow, because it is so wet.
Okay. So I know you've really thought, obviously, long and hard about the yields that go into this, as well as not just whether you're planting corn or soy, but in your case, the solar panels that will be up on that. Randy, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I really appreciate it. That's Randy DeBailey, a farmer from Orion, Illinois, in Henry County, near the Quad Cities. Thanks, Randy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So joining us now are a couple more folks to talk about this, Evan DeLucia and Genevieve Bookwalter. Evan is the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment at the University of Illinois. And Genevieve is a freelance journalist who's been reporting on solar energy in Illinois for The Washington Post. She's on the line from Chicago, where she also writes for the Tribune. Evan, Genevieve, thank you for being with me as well.
Good morning, Nyla.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, Genevieve. Let me start with you. Randy mentioned that he had also applied for another permit for 15 acres in Rock Island, which seems to be a bigger an expansion of what he already has right now. Do we know about how many farmers have applied to install solar on their properties?
The numbers that I am hearing from the state are probably around 1,000 farmers that they were expecting to apply for these contracts, and they're expecting to award about 100 of them, and that should happen later this month.
And so why are they only awarding 100 if 1,000 have applied?
A lot of it comes down to financing. These contracts are guaranteed. They're long-term contracts. We're talking a couple decades. And so to have the money to commit to that, 1,000 would be a lot right now.
Why do you think so many farmers are interested in investing in solar energy, Genevieve? Are they doing the calculation that Randy did for us very carefully there about how productive he's picking land that wasn't yielding very much in the way of crops anyway?
Sure. I think it's a number of things. I think that has a lot to do with it. Also, the soybean prices dropped pretty dramatically last year. And I think if you're doing the calculations, suddenly a yield that, just for example, instead of bringing in two times as much, maybe it brings in three times as much money by putting solar there. I do think it really is that cost-benefit analysis, and also looking for just that steady and reliable source of income with crop prices going up and down the way they are right now. To have a contract, a two-year contract that you know every year you're going to get this much money, there's a lot to be said for that and a lot to be said for diversifying.
Evan, have you had farmers reach out to you at the U of I and ask about installing solar panels on their properties?
Not so much, Nyla, but we have worked with the campus to install solar and have dealt with some of the very same issues that Randy was talking about. You know, how we use land and how we use our prime farmland is a big question and one of the concerns with expansion of solar.
And when you say it's a big question, how we use our land, what do you hear from people? Is it that they feel like you should be using the land to grow things as opposed to putting solar panels on it?
That's the argument. People looking, you know, down the road think about an increasing size of a global population, needing to produce more food to feed that population, and thinking about this land going into other than food production is a concern. But I have to say, Randy is walking the walk, and he's doing it, and I'm super impressed with what he's doing, because he's taken his low-yielding acres, and you know those low-yielding acres are still not terrible, but they are the low-yielding acres, and he's converted those into solar. Those low-yielding wet acres on Illinois farms typically are the places where we have our biggest environmental challenges. Those are the acres, for example, that are leaking a lot of nitrogen to groundwater.
And so he meant when he was talking about runoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he's, you know, a farmer will often look at those low-yielding acres and fertilize them very intensely. And because they're limited by something other than fertility, often waterlogging, that a lot of that nitrogen goes to groundwater and causes problems for us. So he's really walking the walk here and doing a very nice job of sustainably farming his land.
Genevieve, what did you hear from other folks about expressing this concern that Evan did about, I mean, I just wonder where we're at with the amount of people that we need to feed and the land we have to grow food on?
The concerns I am hearing are very similar to the ones that Evan described, that the soil here is so fertile, and that with between the soil, our climate, we get, of course, the hot summers, the cold winters. We have a long enough growing season that we can grow things like corn, that it gets warm enough, long enough that can flourish here, where too far north, not so much, too far south, you run into other problems. We also get a lot of rain, and so irrigation here isn't a concern that it is in other parts of the United States. So I heard some concerns around those as well, just that we do have this this climate that is ideal for growing a lot of crops, and just folks warning to use caution about taking that land out of production and using it for something else.
Evan, I wonder how you would suggest people balance these two. Obviously, when we're thinking about the food we need and the fact that we are pretty well situated to grow that food, not just for us, but for a lot, and oftentimes the rest of the country and the rest of the world in some cases, with obviously the need for renewable energy sources.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I think are important here. You know, I think the average farm size in Central Illinois is north of 1,000 acres, probably about 1,500 acres. That'd be approximately right. And, you know, you think about the land that Randy's invested, it's a very small amount of his farmland. And the benefit there is he's getting stability in his energy bills, and he's getting an income stream that diversifies his financial portfolio, which is super important for farmers that are dealing with all the vagaries of grain prices these days. I mean, so that's kind of a big deal. The other thing I would point out is a couple of things here. One, these are not permanent structures. I mean, you know, they will have a 20-year lifetime, and that farmland is recoverable. It's not like suburban sprawl where you're building roads and buildings on prime farmland. And then another thing I'd just like to mention, this is sort of just at the beginning. There's a really nice research group out in Arizona and another group in France that have been working with this concept called agrivoltaics. And that is asking the question, can we purposefully combine solar energy production with agriculture in the same land? In other words, can you farm under these things? Can you graze under these things? It may not be corn and beans. It may be high value crops. But it is.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. Unfortunately, we are out of time, Evan. We'll have to have you come back and tell us more about that later. But I want to thank Evan DeLucia for being with us, the director of Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment at the U of I, as well as Genevieve Bookwalter. We'll tweet out Genevieve's story on this. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In recent years, you might have gotten used to seeing high-profile hearings and testimonies in front of Congress. Last week, it was Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer. We've also had Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Mark Zuckerberg, James Comey. But there was another hearing on Capitol Hill last week. Just as fundamental to our democracy, maybe not getting as much of attention, it was about election security. We're about a year away from the 2020 Illinois primary and a whole 20 months from the next national election. That might be farther away for most of us in our minds, but election officials here already have that election day in their planning schedules. Steve Sandvoss is the executive director of the Illinois State Board of Elections, and he's on the line now from Springfield. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. It's glad to be here.
So, Steve, as I mentioned, we're kind of a long ways out from our next national election, even if there are lots of people putting up their hands to run already. But I wonder why you went to Washington last week to testify about this issue.
Well, Congressman Quigley reached out to me because his committee is very concerned about our cybersecurity and our preparedness for the upcoming elections in 2020 and beyond. As I think most people are aware, our statewide database of registered voters was hacked into, and as a result of that, we've taken steps to beef up our security, but cybersecurity is an ongoing process, and I think Congressman Quigley knows that, and I think he wants to draw attention to the fact that the election community, not just in Illinois, but in the whole country, is in need of help from the federal government in order to protect our systems and ensure secure elections.
And how does that work when it comes to funding? And when we're thinking about ensuring the security of our systems, how much of that is a federal versus a state funding issue?
Well, I guess that depends on who you ask. I think there's some that believe that the federal government has a very important role, probably a dominant role, in protecting election systems. After all, elections are both state, local, and federal. So I think it's in everyone's interest to ensure that they're protected, and the federal government has more resources than the state. There's probably others that think the state should be the primary driver, both in terms of setting election policy, but also in funding its security. So I think you have a debate among different groups, both at the federal level and perhaps at the state level. I try to make the point, though, that you know I think it's beyond any one state to fully have, protect themselves in terms of the funding necessary to do that, which is why I reached out to them and you know, pleaded with them, so to speak, to fund additional money. You know, looking to the future, because again, we have our cyber protection is expensive to maintain, but we want to keep it going. And of course, the voting machines that you know people use to cast ballots, they're old. They're in some cases close to 20 years old. And like any type of system, you know, after years and years of use, its quality diminishes, and they need to be replaced. And that's not cheap.
And so that's what you want the money for, obviously, not just as you're saying cybersecurity and cyber protection, but to actually replace voting machines. So is this an issue of the machines being old or also or is it also about security?
I think it's a little both. I think the older they get, the more susceptible they become to malfunction, but also as technology gets better and the security that the systems need to you know, be better protected against attack, you know, advancements in technology are ongoing, and you know, the systems you know have to be constantly upgraded. And at some point, you know, the system itself would have to be replaced to accommodate new technology. And I think that's at the point we're at the point right now where that's the case.
And so, how many machines are we talking about, and how much would it cost to replace them?
The figure that I reported to Congress was approximately $175 million. There's over 10,000 machines out there, but each voting system has components as well. So, you know, you could have 10,000 or 12,000 actual systems, you know, for you know, in each of the polling places. Well, I shouldn't say in each of the polling places, but you have 10,000 systems in the state divided among all the polling places, but then each system has components as well. You have actual voting machines, you have marking devices, you have tabulators, which, again, it's in the thousands, and it would be you know expensive to replace, but I think necessary to do so.
And so when we think about that, last year Illinois got just $13.2 million in federal funding. How much are you hoping to get in federal funding? Or I imagine you've been working with Congressman Quigley, other folks in the delegation about this.
Yes, we've had communication not only with Congressman Quigley, but I've had conversations with Senator Durbin and Congressman Rodney Davis, Congressman Kasten. Those three I met when I was out there last week, and I think they're you know, certainly supportive of the state's efforts. And I didn't give them a specific dollar amount, but we'll take whatever Congress will give us to you know further our efforts. And you know, I'm not necessarily overly optimistic that we're going to see additional money immediately. They just gave out that $380 million last March, but as long as we just keep you know the this notion of you know ongoing threats, ongoing necessity of security, and ongoing realization that these voting machines at some point are going to give out. As long as that issue is you know constantly before Congress, I think, or I hope anyway, that they'll see to it that the states get what they need, and they'll do the right thing and provide us what we need. And anything the Illinois legislature can do toward that effort, I think would help as well. And I think they understand you know the issues that we're facing. We have communications with legislative committees on that, and I expect as the legislative session progresses that we'll have additional meetings with legislators to you know, let them know what we're doing, what we need to do, and what resources we need to do it.
My guest is Steve Sanvoss. He's the executive director of the Illinois State Board of Elections. Steve, I wonder, how much you think see this as a bipartisan issue. And I think the issue of voting rights and voting security has become, I would say, fairly politicized in the past couple of years. So I wonder, when it comes to funding for this, do you worry that the partisan politics of this may affect the actual funding of this?
Well, I mean, there's always a political element in the allocation of resources. You know, I'm not blind to that, but I do think that it is a bipartisan concern that the election systems are adequately maintained and that they're protected against attack, either foreign or domestic. So I don't think there's political considerations with respect to that. I mean, there may be disagreements with how much is needed and how much is available. I mean, elections is one area. It's critical, no doubt about it, but there's other areas that are critical too. So, I mean, that's just the nature of politics and debate is allocating the resources to, you know, see where they go. So, I mean, we will speak up for ourselves and what we need, and you know, the politics will you know, bear itself out as is always the case.
Steve, I bet there are people who are listening who think, why don't we just use paper ballots? That seems a lot more secure. Do we need these machines? What would you say to that?
I think that having a paper trail is very important. For purposes of, you know, having an actual physical embodiment of a voter's choice, so that if there's any question after an election as to whether or not the results were tabulated correctly, you can always look back on, you know, the physical piece of paper that contains the votes. So I think in Illinois we don't have that problem. We have a paper trail in one form or another for all the voting machines. Not all states do that, and I think there's a national push for election integrity advocates to get that done, but I think it's important that we have that and to maintain, you know, the confidence that I'm hoping, you know, the electorate has in the accuracy of the tabulation.
When we think about that confidence of the electorate, I wonder what you wish the public knew more about your job in the process. As we think about the whole idea of how much misinformation is out there, especially when it comes to our election and our voting security, what do you wish people knew more about?
I would like for people to go to sources for information that are trusted. Okay, like our agency has a website. All the local election authorities throughout the state, or at least most of them, I think, have websites that provide vital information, especially during the voting days, you know, early voting and on election day itself. And what one of our concerns is that you have a nefarious actor out there who wants to, you know, mess with the electorate and setting up fake accounts, for instance, on Twitter or Facebook or other type of social media, misinforming and causing confusion. That's what we're that's one of the big concerns we have during the voting. And if the people who go to these sites and they see something and it's not an official site of a agency such as ours or the county clerk's office or the Board of Elections office or something like that, then yeah, that could be problematic. So, you know, again, people shouldn't believe everything they see on the internet, especially when stories are out there about, you know, the miscounting of votes, or you know, saying, oh, your vote's not going to count because, you know, the systems are all, you know, subject to hacking and all that. You know, that's not the case. Okay, I mean, I'm not saying that it's impossible to hack into a voting system, but these systems go through rigorous testing and there's a certification process for them. The voting machines themselves are not connected to the internet, so you're not going to get a remote hack through that. Even though our system was hacked, it was a registration system. It was not connected to the actual tabulation systems. So, I mean, it is a little bit complicated. I get that, but you know, if people have questions, you know, by all means, you know, talk to us. We explain things to anyone who asks. We have our social media accounts. You know, we can, you know, respond to questions that people have. And if there's any you know, question as to, you know, what we're doing, you know, by all means, we want to be an information resource, and we want to make sure people get the correct information.
That's Steve Sanvoss, who's the Executive Director of the Illinois State Board of Elections. Steve, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
There are five states in the country without a law dedicated to hate crimes. One of them is Indiana, right across our border to the east. And over the past few months, state lawmakers and the governor have been debating how to change that in the form of a hate crimes bill that's been hashed out between lawmakers. And in recent weeks, that debate has gotten more tense. It's divided Indiana's state government, even though Republicans control both chambers and the governorship. Brandon Smith is the State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and he's on the line now from the state capitol in Indianapolis. Hey, Brandon, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brandon, before we get to this hate crime bill, I wonder if we could talk about Indiana's political climate. When we think about how different it is from Illinois, we have a Democratic governor, Democratic supermajorities in both chambers. Is it fair to say that Indiana's basically the opposite right now?
That's exactly correct. Indiana has a Republican governor and Republican supermajorities in both chambers and has for a while. We've had Republican governors since 2005. We've had supermajorities in the Senate for more than a decade and Republican supermajorities in the House for most of the current decade. So this is after the 2018 elections, Democrats no longer have a single statewide elected official in Indiana.
Wow. And so I wonder if you can tell us the backstory to this hate crime bill. How did it come about when we're thinking about the fact that I wonder who was sort of pushing this when you think about there's just five states that don't have a law about hate crimes?
Sure. Well, there have been Democratic lawmakers in this state pushing a hate crimes bill for more than a decade. Really, if you go back, it's almost like a couple of decades. But they've largely been ignored for a really long time. About 3 years ago, a Republican lawmaker from the northeast part of Indiana started promoting, she authored and was pushing for a hate crimes bill. And that's when it started to gain more traction, understandably, with Republican supermajorities. But it still hasn't gotten anywhere close to the finish line. In fact, over the last 3 years, it's actually made less and less progress each legislative session. However, the conversation really changed last summer, because a synagogue in an affluent Indianapolis suburb was spray-painted with Nazi graffiti, swastikas, the like. And that reignited sort of the conversation in the General Assembly, particularly with Governor Eric Holcomb getting on board after that.
And so what is being proposed right now? Because I understand there's some disagreement about what's been sent to the governor and what he will sign.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of different versions of a hate crimes law around the country, and I don't think any two versions are quite exactly the same. What Indiana's would do is almost the most basic thing that a hate crimes bill can do, which is say to judges in the state at the sentencing phase of a trial. So a crime has already been committed, a person has been convicted of that crime, and at the sentencing phase, the judge can consider whether it was a hate crime, whether there was bias involved in the motivation as to whether or not the person who was convicted of that crime should get more or less time. So there's already a long list of things in state law that a judge can consider. This would add to that long list and say, if the crime happened because of the victim's race, color, religion, gender identity, sexual orientation, a list of characteristics, that would be something that a judge could consider.
Now, that list that you mentioned, that's really what the contentious issue is here between lawmakers, right? Because you just listed out a couple different characteristics of what would make a hate crime. Why is that at issue here?
Well, there's the answer that some people will tell you, and then there's the real answer. So the answer that some people will tell you is that they feel like the list is too limiting, that if you put out this list of characteristics, that leaves people out. So they haven't really provided a lot of examples of who they think are left out, but one would be political affiliation. That's not a part of that list of victim characteristics. So if someone was attacked because they are a Republican or a Democrat or whatever, theoretically that couldn't be considered a hate crime under this law, even though there are interpretations of it that says you could, or under this bill, I should say. It's not a law yet.
Brandon, can I stop you for a second there? Before
sure.
we unfortunately have to take a break, but we will get to your real answer after the break. And
good.
As we are having this conversation with Brandon Smith, who's the State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting, we're talking about Indiana's proposed hate crime law. Stay tuned, stay close. Just after this short break, we'll pick up this conversation with Brandon and get the other half of that answer. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Our neighbors just across the border in Indiana are considering a hate crimes bill. Indiana's just one of five states that doesn't have a hate crimes law on the books. Brandon Smith has been talking with us. He's with Indiana Public Broadcasting about the issue right now with what that law might look like. And so, Brandon, just before the break, you were talking about the conversation is whether or not there needs to be a list of what hate crimes are made on the basis of, right? Whether it's gender or sexual
victim characteristic. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you were saying that Senate Republicans in Indiana took this quote unquote list, the language of that off of the bill. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that was?
Right. So I said that the answer they'll tell you is they feel like the list is limiting and that it leaves people out, that they don't give a lot of examples about who is left out. The real answer, or at least a realer answer, that a lot of folks behind the scenes will tell you is it's about four words: sexual orientation and gender identity. This is a very conservative state, and particularly the chambers are in many ways affected by and governed by religious conservative factions of the Republican Party, and they don't like the idea of recognizing in state law any sort of protection or acknowledgement for members of the LGBT community. And so even though it doesn't say a hate crime is an attack on a gay person or a trans person, it says sexual orientation and gender identity, which heterosexuality and cisgender are covered by that. A lot of folks in the religious conservative community don't like those words, and so that has become maybe the biggest factor in the debate over this bill.
And what is Governor Holcomb's position on this then?
He's been surprisingly steadfast on this. And I say surprisingly because in his 2 years as governor, we haven't seen him flex his political muscle very much. And he's much more of a go-along-to-get-along kind of governor in working with the legislature, at least in public. But he has been very clear from the outset, including after the Senate Republicans took that list out and after the first half of the session ended without any more changes, which was, I want a bill with the list, period. Now, he won't threaten to veto any other kind of any bill that gets sent to him without it, which is probably the next step that happens here, because as it goes to the House, House Republicans have never been in favor of that list of victim characteristics. But the governor has been very, very clear what he wants to see, what he thinks will qualify Indiana to get off, as he likes to put it, the naughty list of the five states without a hate crimes law.
And to the point of that, how Governor Holcomb describes this sort of naughty list of states that don't have a hate crimes law, I wanted to just ask you about how this affects Indiana's business climate. And I think some of our listeners might remember 2 years ago, North Carolina was in the national spotlight for the so-called transgender bathroom bill, and the state actually lost business as a result. I'm thinking the NBA even would not have the All-Star game there. I wonder, are Indiana's public officials, business leaders worried about the business climate aspect of this?
Yes, and that's principally what I think is driving the bill at this point, the conversation forward in a way that it hasn't before. There have always been folks, particularly Democrats, but folks on both sides of the aisle who thought we should pass this bill because it's the right thing to do for these groups of people and for these individuals who are the victims of hate crimes. But the larger business community and a lot of Republicans are on board because it is affecting their business climate. I've heard folks, again, in the hallway talk about when Amazon met with Indiana officials as they were shopping for those headquarters, that was, of course, big public news, the second question was about the lack of a hate crimes law.
Wow.
The second question.
Right.
And that resonates with business leaders for obvious reasons, and resonates with government leaders for obvious reasons. So that is as much, if not the most, driving influence in why the bill has at least gotten a little further this time, even if it's not where a lot of those folks would like it to be.
Brandon, one last quick question for you. You mentioned that lawmakers are out of session. What's likely to happen next year?
Well, it goes to the House now, and as I said, House Republicans aren't in favor of that list, so we'll see how much pressure the governor and business leaders and others can exert on them to try and get that list back in. Otherwise, we may be headed for a gubernatorial veto.
Mm. It's Brandon Smith. He's the State House Bureau Chief with Indiana Public Broadcasting on the line from the state capitol in Indianapolis. Brandon, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
When you think of penguins, you probably picture them in Antarctica, but you may not know there's a species of penguin that is native to Peru. There was a time that Peru's coastline was dotted with hundreds of thousands of these penguins called the Humboldt, but today just about 10,000 remain. But there are two Illinois scientists who are hoping to make a difference for these species, and they're along the line with us now. Mike Atkinson is the Vice President of Clinical Medicine for the Chicago Zoological Society, which runs the Brookfield Zoo. Jennifer Langan is a senior staff veterinarian at the Brookfield Zoo and a clinical professor with the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Both of them are graduates of the college. Drs. Atkinson, Langan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Langan, before we hear about your work, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about this Humboldt penguin. They live on the western coast of South America?
That's correct. There's approximately 10,000 or so penguins that live along the Pacific coast of Chile and Peru. They live in large flocks and nest in sort of cliff-lined or island areas along those waterways that are flanked by the Humboldt Current, the Humboldt Current, which brings their food source.
And so it wouldn't be public radio if we didn't have a sound of what these penguins, we actually have a little bit of what they sound like. Let's take a listen. So thanks to the Internet Bird Collection for that audio. Dr. Langan, how are Humboldt penguins different from penguins we might be more used to hearing about, like the ones in Antarctica, for example?
So these penguins are closely related to those in Africa or in Galapagos. And what's unique about these groups is that they live in a temperate climate. So most people would consider, when they think of penguins living in a cold climate or king penguins that live in Antarctica, these penguins, on the other hand, live in temperatures that are much more mild. It typically does not get to freezing temperatures, and they are usually in sandy or rocky habitats and not snow.
So, Dr. Atkinson, I mentioned that the population has been in significant decline. I wonder during what time period we saw this start happening?
Yeah, they've been under a threat for quite some time now, and it's due to a variety of different factors that are all at play. The two biggest factors are the competition for their food source. So these are an animal that eats a small species of anchovy fish as their primary diet, and that puts them in direct competition with very large-scale industrial fisheries that are also taking those same fish species out of the water. So the restriction in that prey base is one of the things that really drove down the population size initially. They're also, like wildlife all around the world, they're faced with competition with people for habitat. There's been a lot of coastal development in Peru that's taken away some of the nesting habitats that this species uses and puts them in direct conflict with people in other ways in terms of hunting or just disturbance of the flocks away from their preferred nesting areas.
We're talking about the Humboldt penguin with Drs. Atkinson and Langan. And Dr. Atkinson, as I mentioned, we probably actually have listeners right now who are tuning in from Humboldt, Illinois, which is near Charleston, and Chicago's Humboldt Park, this penguin species, the town of Humboldt. These are all named after the same guy, right?
Yeah, so that's Alexander von Humboldt, who was a famous explorer that did a lot of navigation and exploration along the coast of South America.
Okay. So now Dr. Langan, I wonder if you can tell us then about the work that you and Dr. Atkinson did in Peru. Was there a reserve that you all were working on?
Yes, we collaborated with local Peruvian scientists and local conservationists. And in 2007, we started a long-term health assessment project that involved looking at the health of these animals in an area called Punta San Juan, which is about 7 hours south of Lima. At this location, there's been a reserve that is now also a marine protected reserve where penguins have nested for hundreds of thousands of years. This area was actually initially protected because the government was using this site as a guano harvesting area. So that's the bird droppings that were collected to be sold for fertilizer. It's actually one of the first conservation models for harvesting something for the environment. The difficulty is that when financial times got rough, the harvesting potentially was over-harvesting the guano, and that made it very difficult for the penguins to sort of maintain their populations there as they depend on these these large cliffs that have many, many feet of guano to nest in to be reproductively successful.
And so you also have some penguins at the Brookfield Zoo, Dr. Langan. I wonder how the research you guys are doing in Peru and at the zoo work in cooperation?
Sure, that's a great question. So one of the most important things that we were able to combine is both our long-term knowledge of the medical care and husbandry of the animals here at the Brookfield Zoo. We have on average about 10 to 20 Humboldt penguins that are paired up for breeding for conservation for this species. There's a number of different things that we can learn from having animals in our care long-term that we simply cannot gain from simply a short-term experience with free-ranging animals. So some of the things that we can understand here are the reproductive success, how long the birds incubate their eggs, how their weight changes over the year, how their diet and appetite change, health parameters that we were otherwise unable to follow in follow as closely in free-ranging animals, for example.
I wonder, and can people come visit? I assume people can come visit the Humboldt penguins at the Brookfield Zoo, Dr. Langan?
Absolutely. The public can come visit our Humboldt penguins at the Brookfield Zoo in the exhibit called The Living Coast. It mimics the environment that the animals live in Peru and Chile, and it also provides opportunities for backstage encounters where people can get up close with our animals.
Dr. Atkinson, the Brookfield Zoo is just one of many zoos that are helping oversee this penguin survival plan. Ultimately, what are you hoping can happen?
Yeah, we've got a great partnership with the St. Louis Zoo, Kansas City Zoo, Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, and Cayetano University in Lima, Peru. And the consortium of these zoos is very focused on conservation of Humboldt penguins at Punta San Juan, as well as just the broader conservation of the species. Our ultimate hope is that we're able to transition a lot of this conservation over to local Peruvians, and that we are able to build up the capacity and the expertise and their scientists and their teams to be able to do this work themselves. It's obviously a lot more efficient for somebody in Lima to be able to do some of this conservation work than it is for us to be flying back and forth from Chicago. So a lot of our efforts focus on the education and the sort of capacity building of experience to eventually be able to hopefully transition this project off and know that the conservation strategies are going to be successful and that this species will be protected for years to come.
Dr. Atkinson, I read that as a kid you grew up in Decatur working at the Scoville Zoo. I wonder what it was like as an adult to now know that you are in Peru studying penguins, for example.
It's a pretty amazing thing. You know, that was a dream of mine from a kid, was to eventually end up working in a zoo doing largely what I'm doing today in terms of veterinary medicine and conservation. So it's been a pretty incredible journey. It's very exciting, actually, that Scoville Zoo in Decatur does have Humboldt penguins there as part of their zoo collection as well. So that was a pretty exciting thing to see that exhibit come on board a few years ago.
Well, thanks to both of you for sharing your conservation work on the Humboldt penguin with us. Dr. Mike Atkinson, as we've been speaking with him, Vice President of Clinical Medicine for the Chicago Zoological Society, which runs the Brookfield Zoo. I want to thank Dr. Langan for being with us as well, a senior staff veterinarian there at Brookfield Zoo. She also teaches in the College of Vet Med at the U of I. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, Illinois law enforcement agencies have gang databases with thousands of names. Mick Dumke from ProPublica Illinois has been investigating this, and it turns out this information contains a lot of mistakes. And what's more, it's not always clear how or why someone winds up in this database in the first place.
I can tell, Nyla, from looking at this information, that it's not just people who have been arrested or charged or convicted of crimes. There are also people in this database who appear to have been put in there by police officers who just stopped and interviewed them on the street, you know, a stop and frisk kind of situation, and they ended up in the database. So it appears that there's all sorts of different ways you could end up on one of these lists.
Mick joins us on tomorrow's 21st. Tune in for that. Plus, the hosts of the WNYC podcast, Nancy, join us to talk about their series on queer money. We'll talk about how the financial costs of being LGBT can pile up pretty quickly. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a great resource. It's where you can find links, past shows, ways to contact us. If you want to send us a voicemail, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or our social media handles, you can go there. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Thanks to Christine Herman for her help today. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Jason Croft and Steve Mork do all of our technical direction and engineering. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.